Now that I've told you about the selfish Jane theory, the Gaia theory, and the laws of thermodynamics, I can tell you about the discoveries of the Club of Rome that began all of this. All of the discoveries I've been telling you about so far have been scientific discoveries about humanity's relationship to the world. When the Club of Rome was founded, none of this science existed. The Club of Rome started all of this by using the information they did have at the time. They began by studying humanity's relationship to the world by using mathematics. In 1968, humanity's knowledge of the global environment consisted of some numbers. We knew population sizes, amounts of farmland, productivity of farmland, total land area, total productivity of factories, a reasonable estimate of the supplies of natural resources in the world, and some pollution levels. We also had records of how those things had changed over time. That was the most critical part. The Club of Rome figured out how all those things fit together. None of those numbers change independently of each other. Anytime you change any one of those numbers, at least one other number changes. That meant they had discovered the outline of a gigantic mathematical equation for how the world worked like a farm. But nobody knew what it was an equation for, or how to write it down. Basically, they discovered that the world was ruled by some gigantic law of mathematics, and nobody knew what the law was. They didn't have enough numbers to write a literal mathematical equation for what they were trying to study, but they knew there was no way they could get reliable numbers for everything in the world anyway. What they did instead was the next best thing. A few years earlier, some people had discovered a new way to use math with science. This new way let them use a lot less numbers. That let people study much bigger things. That let them study how different things work together, and then move on to studying how that thing worked with something else, instead of having to stop and find numbers first. This is exactly what these scientists needed. This new type of mathematics is called systems theory. Basically, if scientists discovered that the Maya ate corn and tomatoes for a healthy meal, but didn't know how much corn or tomatoes they ate, they could write down corn plus tomatoes equals healthy meal. Then later, if they found out some numbers, they could see how much corn and how many tomatoes it took to make a healthy meal. Or, if they found out how many healthy meals there were, they could write down that and then try to find out how much corn and tomatoes there were. Then, if the scientists found out that another group of people ate wheat and peas for healthy meals, they could write down wheat plus peas equals healthy meal. Now they have two important things written down in a way that makes them easy to read. Now that they can see that both groups of people ate healthy meals, that gives them another clue to see how the people ate healthy meals. If corn plus tomatoes equals healthy meal, and wheat plus peas equals healthy meal, then corn plus tomatoes must contain the same nutrients as wheat plus peas. Now they've discovered another important clue without using any numbers. This seems so simple that no one should need to write this down to be able to figure it out. But if you have whole books full of information and you need to figure out how it all fits together, then finding an easy way to write it all down and see how it all fits together is important. This can also be used to see how different things affect each other when all the numbers are changing. If there were some birds that lived in a forest, and the scientists wanted to figure out how many birds there were each year, they could see that each year the number of birds depended on the number of eggs the birds had laid the year before. That would depend on the number of birds there were in the forest then to lay the eggs. But the more birds there were, the more food they would have eaten, so there might be less food for the birds this year. Also, the more birds there were the year before, the more wild cats there would be in the forest that ate the birds. So this year, the number of wild cats would affect the number of birds, but if the cats ate too many of the birds, there wouldn't be enough food for the cats anymore, so some of the wild cats would die, and so on. To keep track of things like this, you draw what's called a systems diagram. Now you can see if you change one number in the system, which other numbers will change. Then when those numbers change, you can see which numbers they will change, and so on. So, even without knowing what all the numbers are, you can get a good sense of how the numbers change each other. Once these scientists had drawn their systems diagram, they could see that humanity had a problem. Some of the numbers were constant, some were increasing, and others were decreasing. The most obvious problem was that land area in the world was constant, and the population size was growing. That meant there was an inescapable limit on the amount of available farmland in the world. At any level of agricultural productivity, each person requires a certain amount of farmland to produce the food they need to live. If the population kept increasing, eventually there wouldn't be enough farmland to feed everyone. Famine was a mathematical inevitability. The population growth would be stopped by the physical limitation on available farmland. A similar problem was industrial productivity. People kept producing more in factories every year, but there was a physical limit on the natural resources available in the world. People were going to stop producing things in factories eventually, because sooner or later, they were going to run out of natural resources. Factories also give off a lot of pollution. That affects the food productivity of farmland. The more people use factories to produce things, the less food each acre of farmland can produce. So the more acres of farmland it takes to support each person, and the fewer people can be supported with the available farmland. People can use factories to create tractors and other farm machinery, which they can use to produce more food per acre of farmland. That means the food productivity of mechanized farming depends on the consumption of other natural resources to increase food productivity, but it also creates pollution that reduces food productivity. That means that mechanized farming can only produce more food than organic farming as long as the increase in food production from mechanization is greater than the food productivity reduction from the pollution it causes. The systems diagram got a lot more complicated from there, but that's the basic idea. Humanity affects the environment in five ways: population size, usage of material goods, food production, natural resource usage, and pollution. Each person needs food and material goods to live. Material goods are made out of natural resources. Farming, turning natural resources into material goods, and using material goods all produce pollution. The population of the world is growing faster and faster each year. The more people there are, the more babies people are having. The more babies people have, the more people there will be. Then in the next generation, even more people will be having babies. This is called exponential growth. If something creates more of itself, the more of whatever it is you have, the more you create, the more you will have to create more. You can see an example of this by folding a piece of paper in half. If you fold it once, now you have two smaller rectangles in the paper. If you fold it again, you get 4. If you fold it again, you get 8, and so on. Each time you fold the paper, you double the number of rectangles. That means each time you fold the paper, you get even more rectangles than you did the last time you folded the paper. People are having babies that way. If a man and a woman have 2 children together, and so does every other couple in your town, the next generation living in your town will be the same size as this generation. But if each man and woman have 4 children together, now you have twice as many children as you have adults. Now the next generation is twice as big as this generation. If each man and woman in their generation has 4 children together, the third generation will be 4 times as big as the first generation. If each man and woman have four children again, the fourth generation will be 8 times as big as the first generation, then 16, then 32, then 64, then 128, then 256, then 512, then 1,024, and so on. If you and your spouse have four children, and they each have four children, and so on, in 10 generations from now, you will have over 1,000 grandchildren. If everyone else in your town has four children for the next 10 generations, they will each have 1,000 grandchildren also. That means in 200 years from now, your town will be 1,000 times bigger than it is right now. That means if you have 1,000 people living in your town now, in 200 years from now, you would have 1,000,000 people living in your town. But where are all those people supposed to live? Where are they supposed to grow all their food? It's easy to say they could just move somewhere else. But if everyone has been having 4 children all that time, then everyone will be running out of room and everyone will be trying to move somewhere else. This is how everyone would run out of farmland and get into a famine. Solving that problem before we have a famine will depend on people using birth control and limiting themselves to having 2 children or less. We are building factories faster and faster every year also. The more factories we build, the more factories we have to build machines for new factories. Then the more factories we build this year, the more factories we will have to build more factories next year. If you use every 2 factories to produce the machinery for 4 more factories, you've done the same thing. Now all your factories are having lots of baby factories. If Mama Factory and Papa Factory have 4 baby factories, in 10 factory generations from now, they will have over 1,000 grandchildren factories. But factories eat natural resources the same way people eat food. If we run out of natural resources, what will all those poor baby factories eat? That's just a joke. My point is, the more factories we build and use, the faster we use up our natural resources. We are also generating pollution at an exponential rate. If each factory gives off pollution at a constant rate, but we build more factories each year, we give off more pollution each year. The number of factories being built is affected by the number of people there are also. The more factories there are, the more machines there are to build more factories. The more people there are, the more people there are to use those machines. Also, the more people there are, the more people there are who want to buy things from factories. This means factories are not just being built each year. This means factories are not just being built each year to produce the same number of things for an increasing number of people each year. More factories are being built to produce more things for each of the increasing number of people there are each year. Of course, building more factories and running them depends on getting people to work in the factories. So this is another way you've gotten caught up in the story of the world scientists have been discovering. When you put all the numbers together, the population of the world is increasing at an exponential rate, and each person is consuming natural resources and generating pollution at an exponential rate. Humanity's impact on the environment is increasing at a triply exponential rate. Back in 1968, the Club of Rome ran all the numbers through their mathematical formulas. On our current course, we were going to run out of farmland and natural resources sometime in the 21st century. When that happened, billions of people were going to die. Our food productivity depends on our usage of natural resources, because a lot of our natural resources are used to build mechanized farm equipment. If we run out of farmland and our population keeps growing, we will have to start devoting more and more of our natural resources to farming to increase our food productivity. But eventually, we'll use up all our natural resources for building farm equipment, and then there won't be any natural resources left to build any more, or to build spare parts when they break down. Then we won't be able to maintain our mechanized agriculture, so we won't be able to maintain our food productivity. That means we won't be able to produce enough food to keep everyone alive. That means worldwide famine killing billions of people, and inevitably, a lot of wars and plagues along with it. With that set of numbers, most of the population of the world would be dead by 2100. Then the scientists tried changing numbers. They guessed that perhaps we had underestimated the supplies of natural resources in the world. They guessed that people could develop a lot of new technology to solve various problems. They guessed that people would start recycling more, that people would find easy ways to boost the food productivity of their farmland, and so on. They made wildly optimistic speculations, beginning with assuming that there were twice as many natural resources in the world as anyone realized. But no matter what combination of numbers they tried, global environmental disaster always struck in the 21st century, and billions of people always died. Then they tried a different approach to the problem. Instead of changing the numbers themselves, they tried changing the rates at which the numbers were changing. They went back to the real numbers they'd started with. They found that if they just changed two things, global environmental disaster could be avoided, and most people in the world could be better off by the end of the 21st century than they are right now. Of course, 96% of the world's population doesn't live in the United States. By 2100, everyone in the world, including Americans, could have something less than an average United States standard of living as of 1968. Americans would have to make some sacrifices, but global poverty could be ended. By 2100, everyone in the world could have an average United States standard of living as of 1950 or something like that. That's the basic idea, anyway. I'm not talking about owning specific material possessions. I'm talking about everyone working for a living, getting enough to eat, living lives free of oppression, and dying of old age, and having all the things they need to make those basic things possible. In 1972, four scientists from the Club of Rome published their discoveries in their book, The Limits to Growth. By doing that, they changed the very future they had predicted by raising people's awareness of the problem and people acting differently as a result. That was the whole reason they published their book. Unfortunately, it didn't change the future nearly enough. Books can't change people's behavior. People have to change their own behavior. A lot of good came of their publishing their book, so 20 years later, they started working on a sequel as an update. By now, there were environmental activists hard at work all over the world. But when the scientists started putting all the numbers together again, they realized the news wasn't nearly as good as it appeared on the surface. They titled that sequel, Beyond the Limits to Growth. 10 years later, they wrote another sequel called The Limits to Growth, The 30-Year Update. They published that in 2002. They had a lot more information, a lot more numbers, and a lot more science to use by now. And all the numbers still indicate global environmental disaster and billions of deaths in the 21st century. In The Limits to Growth, The 30-Year Update, the scientists give a lot of specific examples of ways to recognize that problems are growing and what would need to be done to solve them. Basically, right now, we're living 20% beyond what the world can sustain. 20% of the things we're using right now are things we need to keep the global environment functioning. To solve the problem, all we have to do is to use our resources differently. Cutting down on the world's population is essential, but we can do all of that we need over time just by everyone having smaller families. Reducing our population size could be accomplished over generations by each woman limiting herself to having whatever number of children would let two of them grow up to be adults. In the United States, that means having two children. In countries with high child mortality rates, that means something more than two, at least until their living conditions improve. The population decrease could be left to some women choosing to have less than two children or not being able to have children for whatever reason. Zero population growth necessarily depends on people identifying all the problems that make population growth seem like a good idea to them and changing them. For instance, in a lot of third world countries, large families are how people provide for themselves for their old age. Parents have 6 or 8 children so that when they're too old to work anymore, their children will be able to provide for them. But if every couple in your country has 8 children, you get 400% population growth every generation, which means 4 times as many people having to feed themselves every generation just to be able to feed their parents. That means every generation in the country needing 4 times as much farmland as the last generation. The environment can't withstand that forever, which means sooner or later the country is going to run out of farmland. Using our resources differently will mean using them more efficiently and redistributing a lot of them. That means gigantic economic and political changes. With our current political and economic systems, the easiest way to cut 20% out of our impact on the environment would be to take it from the people who are already the poorest and therefore the least politically powerful. But that will never work because half the population of the world already barely has enough to eat. Escaping the environmental crisis requires a redefinition of the concept of rightful ownership. Rightful ownership won't be determined anymore by who can buy what, but by who needs things the most. That includes things our descendants, who haven't been born yet, will need. A big question facing everyone is, where do we get more energy? The answer is, we already have the energy, we're just letting a lot of it go to waste. The immediate problems that overpopulation is causing could be solved by our cutting back on our environmental impact by 20%. The term overpopulation only refers to what number of people your economic relationship to the environment can support. A better term than overpopulation would be overexploitation of the environment. Once again, solving this problem depends on identifying the problems that make overexploiting the environment seem like a good idea to people and solving those problems. A lot of people cry and say that the world is going to end if we change our economic system. No, only capitalism will end if we change our economic system. As long as people need food to eat, there will always be work for people to do. In the same way that overpopulation can be ended by women practicing zero population growth, overexploitation of the environment can be ended by people practicing zero economic growth. An increasing population requires an increasing exploitation of the environment to maintain the same economic level for the people. People can also overexploit the environment by trying to raise their economic level. People can do both at the same time, which is what humanity as a whole is doing right now. Zero population growth makes zero economic growth possible. Zero economic growth means that every time one factory machine breaks down, you build one factory machine to replace it. Zero economic growth makes solving the environmental crisis possible. Once you stabilize your economic relationship to the environment, you can cut 20% out of your environmental impact and be down under the physical limitations of the environment. Cutting 20% out of an ever-increasing economic relationship to the environment doesn't accomplish anything in the long run. Technically, you're not cutting 20% out of your economic relationship to the environment, you're just making it more efficient. But as long as you keep making a problem worse faster than you're making it better, you're not solving the problem. An ever-increasing economic relationship to the environment that's made 20% more efficient only produces 20% more. It doesn't reduce the environmental impact of your economy. If you make your economy more efficient, but your economy keeps growing, soon enough you're going to use up whatever you saved at first. An end to economic growth doesn't mean an end to economic development. People are always looking for new and better ways to do things. With an end to economic growth, people would still be free to find new and better ways to use the economy they have. Basically, equating economic development with economic growth is just economics for lazy people. The next big question is, where do we cut 20% out of our environmental impact? The short answer is, everywhere. In fact, the best solution to the environmental crisis is to cut as much as possible out of the environmental impact, because everything we cut out of it beyond 20% is a safety margin we're building into our economic relationship to the environment. It isn't possible for us to say that we're overexploiting the environment by exactly 20%, and neither is it possible to say exactly what that 20% refers to. We might be overexploiting one part of the environment by 10% and another part by 30%. Ultimately, we won't be living at the physical limitations of the Earth until we're living below the physical limitations of the Earth, because we can get a good idea what the physical limitations of the Earth are, but we can't be exactly certain. Environmental sustainability depends on keeping a safety margin and monitoring our relationship to the environment, so that if we start seeing warning signs that we're overexploiting the environment, our safety margin will give us time to react. In the Limits to Growth, the 30-year update, the scientists give a lot of examples of warning signs that an environment is being overexploited. Basically, when you have to start devoting more and more of your economy to making your economy continue to function, you know you're in trouble. The eternal question of any economy is, where are the resources the economy depends on going to come from? Some warning signs are, having to invest more in claiming low-quality resources because the high-quality resources are gone. Having to invest more in claiming hard-to-reach resources because the easy-to-reach resources are gone. Having to clean up your own pollution because the environment isn't cleaning it up fast enough anymore, or at all. Poverty increasing because resources are being diverted away from people who need them. Healthcare and education systems breaking down because resources are being diverted away from maintaining quality of life just to maintain life, period. People fighting wars over resources because there aren't enough to go around anymore. This is exactly what you and the people who are trying to take your farms are doing. Governments breaking down because the decision-making elite takes advantage of their positions to protect themselves. All of these things are happening in the United States right now and a lot of other places in the world. I bet a lot of them are happening in Mexico.